Okay, it's Friday.
Third is 13th.
Okay, it's the 12th. Today is 12 December 1986. My name is Steve Frangos. I'm in Sarasota, Florida. I'm with the Bureau of Florida Folklife Programs, and I'm in the home of Mr. Joe McKinnon. And we're going to talk about his history and career working with circuses around the country.
I'm going to read, maybe, because this may show up in anything I say, so I'm going to read something from my book that's going to be coming out sometime this winter, which will be a freebie. It's going to be given to the investigative reporters and this, that, and the other, and will be free. I've got 2,000 copies out to come out, and I'm going to read something from inside the front page. I have been pretty harsh in my reporting the antics of overeducated souls and souls. But I do have nothing but respect for good educations. This is evidenced by the fact that I have attended classes in 5 universities and colleges, whereby I obtained a very good education. No degree, however. I do get upset when some holder of a degree or degrees sets himself up as being all-knowing and tries to implement things learned in school without having the proper experience to back it up.
Well, now, just for the record here, and I also understand the Smithsonian's also come by to talk to you. Mm-hmm. But Mr. McKinnon, how old are you?
I'll be 80 next July.
Okay, where were you born?
Paris, Tennessee, and I don't usually admit it. I went to Texas when I was fairly young. That's why it's all been, you know, good thing done.
When did you first become involved with working with circuses and carnival businesses?
At 3 years old, I told my parents I was going to be a circus man, not a preacher. At 12, I ran away with the old Sells Florida Circus out of Paris, Tennessee. I tell everybody they didn't have seats on the whole hammers in my papa's cotton patch. And I ran away to the circus. I managed to stay one night before the family managed to catch it, come down and get me off the next day. But I had no intention of ever doing anything else in life but being a circus man. At 14, I ran off the carnival, and that didn't work out too well. And I came home, I studied what could get me on a circus right. I went to the Santa Fe Railroad when I was 15, went to work as an apprentice, learned to build the old-time railroad, wooden coaches. I put 4 years and 8 months in. There's 14 allied trades, including cabinet making and all the other things, even upholstery work with it. Learning to be a coach carpenter in those days, and 832 hours in drafting school at night.
Very good. Now, when did you like first work full time with these
various? As soon as I finished the apprenticeship, I was not quite 19 years old. I wrote Jerry Mugovan, who owned the American Circus, one of the 3 owners of the American Circus Corporation in Peru, Indiana. I said it this way: Mr. Mugovan, I'm a railroad coach builder, and you have railroad coaches and I can repair them. And I went up, it's 1928, I went up for winter quarters in Peru, Indiana. The first job I did, built a new vestibule on one of the old wooden coaches. And Mr. Mugwin and Mr. Bowers, one of his partners, were down and looked it over, asked me what it cost. I said I figured it, my pay was about $15, I think, for. We did it in 3 days, and I had a $3 a week man, so it was a help of me. It was about $1.50 of his wages, material about $112, $14, and I said, about $135, I think, Mr. Mugovan. He turned to his partner and said, Bert, we paid Hoskins Bluehl in Chicago $1,800 for a job no better than this last year, and we had to ship the car to Chicago. From then on, I was a bright-haired boy of the American Circus Corporation because they had a lot of old wooden sleeping cars. On the road, I went on the road. I was the highest-paid man in winter quarters at 19 years old. The managers were getting $10 a week, and I was getting $25. I went on the road. They had to give me that salary year-round for me to stay. All the other shows had heard of me. They wanted me, and they had a lot of shows. I had coaches in those days. So I got 25, which doesn't sound like anything now, but it was a big salary in those days when you had your expenses all paid. And so they had to give me a job on the road every year that would be worth where I was earning that salary. And so I worked up with the front door, with ushering, candy butching, ticket selling, assistant superintendent, up to superintendent. And I got more salary, big superintendent, of course. But that's how I worked up in it. By 1934, Ringland had bought most of the shows up and taken a lot of them off the road. And I had to go what the circus people in those days said you had to do, go corn island. So I joined the big carnival. And on the carnivals, I'm back and forth, circus and carnival. One year I'd be the circus, next year I'd go back to the carnival where I'd make a living a little better. And in that next 6-7 years, I worked on 4 big carnivals. I redesigned the entire midways as I had the job title as superintendent. One case, superintendent designing engineer. I don't know who put that designing engineer. I didn't get any extra pay for it. And I redesigned the entire carnival midways. I put the first neon ever put on a carnival midway. I put the first chrome metal ever put on a carnival midway. Also the first plastic and first fluorescent lighting. And on the new fronts, what we call modernistic show fronts designed. I put the first overhead lighting system on a carnival midway.
Now, you were also telling me about the distinction about carving and putting on the sides of wagons and this sort of stuff and along the carnival. Could you talk to me a little bit about that?
I consider wood carving, which I can do. It's just one of the things I picked up. I'm highly skilled with my hands on cabin making because of the coach building and furniture making. And so I picked up a little wood carving on the side, watching those circus wood carvers work. I picked it up. I've got a set of tools, I think, someplace up at the farm. And so I'm not above, though. I'm not an old-time wood carver. I'm not above taking an electric drill with some gouges and going ahead and doing it that way. Which the old doctor, it killed the old doctor, so what did that happen when he see me doing that? But anyway, on the rest, I consider a good wood carver. My book's a good wood carver, and I saw one over Salisbury a couple of years ago, actually on an expedition over there, on a street show. And I consider one who in 2 hours will have a lot of wood carving, have shavings up around his knees, to his knees, if he's got a big figure to rough it out, and not a pick, 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 pick. I don't consider that wood carving. Any person can get some wood carving tools, and they pick long enough, they can make figures out of it. Mm-hmm. But a good wood carver, he goes in and gets himself a block all glued up properly, and goes in there and starts, he'll have shavings up to his knees. And they will get a figure made. For instance, married around horse wood carvers. That actually the bodies, well, some of the big merry-go-round carousel to the overeducated horses were made sort of mass produced. One guy did the heads, another did the bodies, and another did the legs, and he assembled the darn things. But a good wood carver used to be able, a good merry-go-round horse man would do at least 2 horses a week. Hmm. Of course, so was weeks. We're 6 10-hour days, you know.
Well, now, so you were on the, just to underline this again, you were on the spot and you actually saw these people cut these things away, right?
I have seen those people do that. I worked with them. I worked on, for instance, on those carnivals. We had wood carvers over there working on those.
Merry-go-round?
Yeah, and the first job I ever did on a carnival was rebuild a merry-go-round. Hmm. Including restoring the carvings on all the scenery, including the horses. Horses had legs off of them, heads off of them, this, that, and the other. I had to re-glue them and make anything that's missing, put parts in and all that. That was the first job I ever did on a carnival. And this is aside, I was pretty ashamed of the whole damn thing, being over there working on a merry-go-round after I'd left the circus that had 350 head of baggage horses. And if any one of my circus friends had ever showed up at winter quarters, I'd have probably got out of the carnival business and never come back, seen me out there meddling with these old wooden horses. I'd have probably quit car my business and gone to circus, but I had to be a working man.
You've also written a lot about circus history here, as I can see right in front of me. When you were saying that there, just to go back on a little bit of this, when you were saying there was no definitive history written on carnival, when did you first start to realize that writing about this stuff was sort of like mandatory because it wasn't
anything? It was mandatory because it wasn't anything. I started realizing it back while I was at the museum, I guess. Well, about the time I started the museum. We'd had our own show on the road, Mrs. McKenna and I, the biggest 10 dramatic company that ever toured, 3,200 seat 10 theater. And we got more and more difficult to get good people, working men. And so finally I gave up in disgust and we quit the road. Then I could start to look back at it and see what had happened. And on circus history, is the biggest can of worms ever put out anywhere, and there's more mythology in circus history than is truth. P.T. Barnum's Struggles and Triumphs, with which he wrote 20 versions, 20 editions, he had 20 a new edition every year, is the biggest piece of mythology in American literature, and I can prove it. Now, unfortunately, all the overeducated historians who try to touch on circus history because they want a biblo a mile long to start with, and so they go out and they wind up, here's a beautiful book by P.T. Barnum, the king of all of them, and they use it as their foundation. And practically every so-called circus historian written anything about circus history in this country today has a mythology as its foundation. And so I said, well, I'm not going to get in that mess. I'll have nothing to do with circus history. I'm going to write about carnival history because nobody's ever, and it is a comparatively new business. The first organized carnival, as we know it, was in 1899. Well, they had one in 94, after the Chicago World's Fair of 93. There's one put out by an Orange County in the last 2 weeks. There's another one the next year, it lasts about 3-4 weeks. But as far as one making a full season was the 1899 season, and it was put out by a hotel man, not a carnival man, put out by a hotel man out of Canton, Ohio. And it went out and lasted for 22 weeks. It went out on, carnival basically is nothing. This is tape machine.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Basically, a carnival is a collective amusement organization of maybe as high as, well, with all the concessions on, you can be as high as 200 individual owners on one of the big carnivals. It's a collective amusement organization. And so, the first one was 99, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. Nobody had ever written a history about it, and a little bit, I'll digress here for a minute, when the New York University, NYU, had a popular entertainment seminar about 6 or 8 years ago at Lincoln Center. I wasn't invited. Had a couple of college professors up there to talk about circus. And when they found I was there, they tore their speeches all to pieces out in the lobby before they come in. A friend of mine come in laughing about it. They're out there tearing their speeches up, their papers up, said Joe McKinnon crucifies. We say that. Good. But they didn't have one word about American Carnival, and NYU had never learned that they had the biggest piece, over 600 carnivals in the country, with over 200,000 people involved in them, and NYU owned popular education, owned popular entertainment, they had nothing on them up there. And they're just now working it into their schedules. But none of the historians had gotten to carnival yet, so I decided to write a definitive carnival history, pictorial, before they got to it and messed it up.
What year about was this?
This is 1968-69. I was curator of the museum while I was writing it, and I put it together sitting right here one summer, and by sitting here in my underwear with a breeze. I wrote a definitive carnival history. It has now gone to 23 foreign countries, including three countries, Moscow, Warsaw, and East Germany, 20 other countries. I market it myself, I publish it myself, I market it myself. I had to publish it myself to keep the integrity of my work, because some editor is going to change one word, and in talking about outdoor show business, which is a foreign to most people, nobody, no matter how good a writer they are, can use the terminology, and if you change one word, you may have changed the whole meaning of it. And so I had to publish my first book, and I just continues to publish them ever since, to keep from being edited and meaning the words changed. In fact, last week, a little girl phoned me wanting an interview at the newspaper about the Jomar car they wanted to restore. I'm the only man in America that knows anything about that car. It's left. I know anything. I tore it all to pieces one year, 20 quarters out here. But when she started repeating back, she had changed the story to where didn't anything I said, and I said, don't use my name, don't use me anywhere in the news to come out on that the other day. Because I've had it happen time after time. You cannot, on an interview, if the newsboy writes a story, newspaper person, unless he's there to troop with the show, he cannot write it with any authority. He will change a word or two here and there from an interview, and it means altogether something else.
Well, now, when you were working, Mr. McKinnon, it just struck me, when you went to get your job, of course, you were working on the railroad cars.
Yeah.
But did they not still at that time have wagons, or was this after
wagons? They had wagons.
Did you
but
work
never
on?
Was I a wagon builder. That was a low-class job. Anybody could do it. They had anybody doing it. We had one guy in charge of wagon shops who was a good wagon builder. The guy, but they used $3 a week hands just like I did. I had some pretty good coach carpers after about 5 years of the service. I had those $3 a week hands. They give a regular hands $3 a week, keep them in winter quarters, the best hands, and fed them and so on. All right, I had some pretty good men, could sandpaper coaches, do everything that should be done to get the high class job on those things. They went with me from one show to another.
Well, can you remember their names? Kind of men. I mean, you know, I know we're reaching back here, but
they all dead now.
Yeah,
just saying. Well, Canned Heat Mickey.
What was his name, sir?
Canned Heat Mickey.
Candy Mickey.
I don't know what his name was. I wasn't around when Social Security came in. All those guys like Cold Orange On and Sheet Orange Shorty and Canned Heat Mickey and Doughbelly Harry and those guys. That they were on the payroll like that back in those days. And when the Social Security went in 37, I was here and working winter quarters here in that particular winter. I rebuilt a train out on the Ringland winter quarters that winter for the Ringland show. And I went back to Carnival the middle of the summer, the next summer. But those guys had to get a name for Social Security. There were a lot of fake names made up out here in winter quarters that year. All over the country in the show business, they had to get names for Social Security, which they've had to use ever since.
And you said that just to continue with this line of thought about building, that when you were working on at the Ringling Museum, that you had redone one of the cars, the number nine,
number nine, at blacksmith shop wagon. I had a funny incident there. I said I never was a wagon builder, and I never was. But I had been assistant superintendent of the concessions the year before in the Ringling show, and on the Hagenbeck Wallace show. I didn't want to go back on the same job the next year. I refused to stay on a job more than 2 years anyway, because I was all around showman. And so the manager of the show, who wore special built shoes with turned up toes, one of my dearest friends incidentally, tried to keep me on that show rather than give me another job after I'd finished rebuilt the train that winter as usual. So
what was his name?
Jess Edgins. He's in the center of that book. It's The very center of that book right there is one of the all-time greats, right beside James A. Bailey. And anyway, the best circus my owner I ever knew. I never knew Mr. Bailey. Bailey died the year, he died the year before I was born. But anyway, he was 4th of July and I'm 3rd of July. Bailey Barnum was the 5th of July, so we cancers. But anyway, I called and I said, you turned up, told son of a bitch, take the show and stick it up where it should be, and walked off. And I come over to the Ringling show and I worked the blacksmith shop for two months. And I out of that number 9 wagon, and just had to get said, finally sent me a nice letter, said to get over your mad and come on back home. And I went over, I got the job I wanted, and went back home again. And that's the only time I ever had a working man job on a circus, is that 2 months in the number 9 wagon. So I had a little affinity to that wagon, and it was rotted down out of Warner Course, out at the museum, had acquired it, and it was absolutely complete mess. And I didn't want to see the old wagon messed up by, there's some people in there restoring, it's supposed to have been restoring a couple of wagons. I can go out there and show them to you. You can look across the yard and see where they were stored. They don't have the proper lines on them. And so I was sure that wagon wasn't going to be messed up, and I volunteered to restore that wagon. And restoration, I mean restore and not rebuild. Maybe you first rebuild the structure, which I did, put all new hickory and everything in where it's supposed to be. Then, incidentally, I traveled all over this country getting square nuts. You can't get square nuts in a hardware store anymore, and getting square nuts, so it would be authentic restoration. I've gone in little country hardware stores all over the country and bought boxes of bolts to get the nuts. And the square head, and also the square head shank bolts. And then that's how authentic I tried to make those restorations. Now, I was never a wagon builder. What I did that 2 months I was with the Ringling Show, I repaired the wagons on the lot. I and another man, a helper. And any breakage or anything happened. But I was not a wagon builder. And that's all the wagon builder ever did. But I did the number 9 wagon. I built it. It looked like a brand new wagon, fresh out of Winter Quarters, brand new. Well, that wasn't a restoration, because we were showing, in that exhibit, we were showing the circus as it was after a long, hard season. And so I took a log chain and beat the sides, all that new siding and things, I beat them with a log chain to get dents in it where they should be. Then I took wood rasp and went on under where the pole racks were on the wagons and rasped off the corners and everything where they would be worn by the poles on the season. And that's what I consider a restoration. And I was not a wagon builder to start with. I restored about 12 or 14 of the wagons over at the museum at the present time, including the 4 sideshow front wagons. And in spite of what the girls out there may mouth in their lectures, that front wagon is not a sideshow banner line. It's a sideshow front. Banner line was a bunch of rag banners that waved in the breeze, hung on poles. Those wagons were fronts.
Now, when you were saying earlier that you and your wife had gone and had a show yourself, and
we had the biggest tent dramatic show that ever toured.
Yeah, now
tent repertoire company.
Oh, I see. Because you can't tell us on tape, but in the other room there are all these dolls, and it looks like a stage and stuff. What
that's
sort of
well, that's a puppet stage.
Puppet stage.
She had puppets in there. She made puppets for Tony Sarg. She is, mm-hmm. Was a doggone top portrait sculptress. Mm-hmm. She made puppets for Tony Sarg as a hobby, and she's made puppets for our show. We used them for vaudeville acts on our show. Our son carried out a tent show. Called Puppets and People, in which he did Noah and the Ark and Jack and the Beanstalk and one other show in the repertoire. There were people working on stage with the puppets.
And what was your, when you were touring, what was your thing called? I mean, what was your show called?
Well, the first year, Mary McKinnon Players. her using my last name, Mary McKinnon Parrish. She'd never been on the road with the show before, and I didn't know whether she liked it or not. She didn't. But anyway, we used a repertory of three top Broadway hits, Arsenic, No Lace, Over 21, and Kiss and Tell. Every one of them had been top hits, and all of them had been made into movies. And this was 1946, right after the war, the most beautiful outfit ever built. I know I built it myself and designed it, and it was built what we show people think of. Beautiful anyway, it was flashy but beautiful. And then digression again, I own art. I think the best American art that has ever been done in America was the old time. I mean, 1880s, 90s, and early 1900s, circus poster designs. I don't think anything else in American art has ever come up to them because of the designs and the color and everything in it. But anyway, we carried this Tent Dramatic Company with these three shows. I designed the 23 different types of circus paper. I designed my own paper, and the show print companies put it out for us. And the main thing was, Broadway comes to Main Street. And I put it in towns of about 50 or 60,000 population all through the South and Southwest. And we found after losing money for 3 months, that Main Street didn't give a damn whether Broadway ever come to Main Street or not. We had top caliber people, we had a hell of a show.
How many people did you have in your show?
We had, at one time, I had 40 people on stage. And we showed 60 or 70 people a night some nights. So we had a 3,200 seat tent theater. And so as a result, Most tented circuses on the road today don't have that many seats. But anyway, we, middle of the season, I closed for 2 weeks and rehearsed new shows, and we put on old-time farces and started breaking even, started making the nut with it. Hmm. The next year, I went to the old-time Toby shows.
What are Toby shows, sir?
Toby is the American version of Hans Wurst, of the German drama. In German drama, there's a character for 200 years in German drama. Hans Wurst is written into almost all of their folk plays and their operas and everything. I've seen an opera that had a Hans where the staff had gone out front and narrated every scene. And this guy was usually a country bumpkin in the German folk plays. And he was our Hans Wurst of our American folk opera, folk shows. All right, one time we had 1,200 tented dramatic companies touring this United States back in the 20s, before the talkies came in. We had them. And the talkies and the depression cut them down to about 15. When we had our show out, there wasn't more than about 8 or 9 left. That's right after the war. And we were the biggest that ever gone out. And This guy was written in, Toby was written in as a character, as a comic, in most all of the tent show plays from the mid-20s. Oh, he started about mid-teens. Before that, they had to be great doing the great old-time acting on them, just like they were in the town halls. The tent dramatic companies come, which were an offshoot of the old town hall. Old 10, 20, and 30, they call it. Back 10, 20, 30, they called it. As 10, 20, and 30 cent for town hall shows. And some of the greatest actors of the 80s, 90s, and early 1900s appeared in those town halls at 10, 20, and 30 cents. They're across America. Our museum, we have a museum up in Mount Pleasant, Iowa. Incidentally, this guy went muck up there yesterday and killed Sick Mary and a lot of other people in Mount Pleasant. But anyway, the old Thrashers reunion grounds, we have Repertory Americana Museum up there on the grounds that houses more stuff than anything else on that era, and it's operated right now. Our curator up there, I'm on the board. The curator up there is an old tent show actress and part owner, Carolyn Schaffner, of the Schaffner shows. And that's just a digression there on anything.
Well, that's all right. That's good. Well, where, now your wife, where did she learn how to make puppets? I mean, was this just out of her?
Oh, just picked it up, just like these dolls. Most all those dolls in there, she's made the either repaired the wardrobe or made new wardrobe for them for the sexes of them. Sometimes we find doll heads in Europe. On a European tour, we'll find the head of a doll. She'll analyze that doll head maybe for 4 or 5 years, deciding what that doll's supposed to be. We got one of the most beautiful nuns you ever saw that she decided it was, and she's right. That's the only thing that face that ever fit, to be a nun. And so all the rest of it is her building. The doll is a museum out of it, really.
When you say that she was a sculptress too, did she have like any kind of training in sculpting? Or?
Oh yeah, she studied in Paris, she studied in Berlin, and she studied in Tokyo.
Where was your wife born in the United States?
She was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, one of the Minnesota damn Yankees. She gets mad when I call her a damn Yankee.
Where?
Keeping you from that.
Except my breakfast. I don't want to eat breakfast anyway.
So we're saying your wife's father was English?
He was English. His father came over from England, an engineer, and designed. He did design, he did some work on Central Park when they built Central Park in New York. Hmm. But he moved out to Minnesota and died briefly and left my father-in-law. I think he was the youngest, and had 10 or 12 English brothers and sisters, and those English brothers and sisters weren't going to do any work, if you don't know the truth about it. So at the age of 12, my father-in-law started work for a drugstore downtown Minneapolis. They had a support family. They had a farm outside town, out south Minneapolis. And by the time he was 21, he owned the biggest drugstore in town. Then he built his house. 53 years ago, he invented a little mouthwash. It's worth a heck of a lot more than that. I healed up an ulcer with it. Wish I'd had for 20 years. Doctor said I'd done good with it. He invented a mouthwash called Lavoris.
Lavoris?
My wife was a Lavoris mouthwash.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's the reason we could go to Europe and do all the other little things we want to do. Well, it now belongs to a little pharmaceutical company up in New Jersey. We don't own any stock. We unloaded their last stock a few years ago. Rich, Vic, we sold out to Vic. And Rich, become Rich and Vic. We did right well with that trade.
And where was your family from, sir? You said you were from Tennessee, but what's
your family? The McKinnons, we spell it a little different than the rest of them. McKinnons were run out of Ireland in 854 for some reason or other. I don't know whether we got too tough for them or what. Anyway, there were more of them, and they rushed us. We run out. We got three offshore islands off of up in the straits above Glasgow, about 1280 something. Some of the McKinnons have managed to get a foothold on the mainland of Scotland. And I checked in a hotel. We spell our name M-C-K-E-N-N-O-N. It's supposed to be spelled, American spelling, M-C-K-I-N-N-O-N, but I guess we've always been pretty aggressive. And so my family must have got mad at the others and went down into North Carolina. And immigrated on to Tennessee and then on to Texas. And there's quite a lot of McKinnons, M-C-K-E-N-N-O-N. But I checked in the hotel there, and I did, and the kids in Glasgow here about 25 years ago, well, 30 years ago now, and signed in to Joe McKinnon, M-C-K-E-N-N-O-N. 5 days later, when I got my bill, it was Mr. Joseph W. M-A-C-K-I-N. I didn't know how to spell my own bloody name. But we never were Highlanders. And we have come over to North America and pretty well populated Canada. Different branches of the family. And down in northern Louisiana and southern Arkansas, had a big McKinnon cotton plantation, in fact, here about 15, 20 years ago. That McKinnon cotton plantation drew $1 million government check for not growing cotton, I think it was, something like that.
Yeah.
So the family, some of the family over there, pretty well fixed, I guess, cotton growers. But that's not the amazing thing about this, is there's a tribe of McKinnons over there. I guess more McKinnons are spelled the name way I do, in this tribe over there, northern and southern, and every time one of them was black as ace of spades. Because when the McKinnon slaves were freed, they took our names. So evidently that's a good recommendation for the family. We didn't mistreat them, they wouldn't have taken their names.
Yeah.
And anyway, we moved to, I ran away with a circus, as I said a while ago, I ran away with a circus when I was 12. Family come and got me, but we went within 2 months, we'd sold the cotton farms and everything and moved to Texas, down south of Fort Worth, Cleburne, Texas. That's where I served my apprenticeship with a railroad company. I've been with the circus for 4 years, 3 years, I guess, but I've been in the circus 3 years when Jerry Muggerman told me, Joe, you got everything caught up around quarters, why don't you go back to school? So I went back, got my senior year in high school. I was 23 years old when I graduated from high school. Mr. Muggerman, unfortunately, sold his shoulder to England, and he had an unfortunate operation and died. It was unnecessary, but he did. But even then, Mrs. Muggerman, for the next 4 years, would send me my money to go to the University of Texas and for the fall semesters. I'd go down and get fall semester, and then get back in winter quarter to get the train ready and stay on the road with a job. School started the fall, but I left school. And
well, let me just interrupt you 1 minute here, Mr. McKinnon, just so I can clear this in my mind. When you got, when you apprenticed on working on the railroad cars, now my dad's a carpenter.
Yeah.
And he was a cabinet man.
You see, the interior of those old-time railroad cars,
mm-hmm.
Well, the exterior first. The exterior were made with poplar siding, which we sandpapered. We jack-planed it down first. If you were a carpenter, you know some of the terminology. Jack-planed it down, and had a beater to make the beads. Then we scraped it with a cabinet scraper. That's the exterior. Then we sandpapered it with number 1.5 sandpaper down to the, then we used number 0 sandpaper for the final finish. Then in the paint shop it had 3 rubbing coats put on and wound up with 4 coats of varnish. With after the color and everything went on, so it had 9-10 different operations in the paint shops. Now that was the exterior, but we didn't consider the exterior much.
Yeah.
The interior of those coaches were all rare woods, and all hand inlaid and all that stuff. And that's where we had the, I worked 9 months in the cabinet shop doing that kind of work.
What did they call you when you came out? I mean, were you like a master carpenter? What did they refer to?
We were just a coach carpenter.
Just a coach carpenter?
Yeah. And I was the last apprentice that I know of anywhere in America that signed up as a coach carpenter apprentice. From then on, they were coach builders because the steel coaches were
Right.
On the railroads, we're taking a wood coach out of existence. And so I served an apprenticeship that was obsolete when by the time I came out of my trade.
Hmm.
And I started the apprenticeship, incidentally, at 27 cents an hour.
27 cents.
6 days a week.
6 days a week. How many hours did you work a day?
Eight. We were down to 8 hours already. God bless Henry Ford. We were down to 8 hours a day. But 10 hours, 6 days a week. Then I got at the end of 6 months, I got a 2.5 cent raise. Next 6 months, another 2.5 cent raise. And by the time I put in 4 years in the crowd, I'm getting every bit of 46 cents an hour. And when I went out of my apprenticeship, I worked a few weeks as a carpenter in the shops at 72 cents an hour. That was the top man.
That's incredible. Jesus.
So when I went over the service for $25 a week, I didn't know they were going to board me. They won't know what I come for, and I cut out, and I was getting about 35 the railroad company. I cut out some of it, and I didn't know they were going to board me. And I went over 25, but I earned my pay over there.
And what kind of, we're talking in the 20s, everything was had to be hand tools at that time?
Everything had hand tools.
No power stuff.
No. In fact, today's mechanics building houses, I call them power saw carpenters, power saw carpenters.
Sure.
And I ain't seen any one of them yet that could do a real good tight fit with a power saw. It takes that hand tool to do the real ones. You can't put a knife blade in the joint.
Yeah, well now, you see what, it's a real thing on the job now to have power tools. And they don't hire you unless you have
them. Yeah, well, you had to be. And I've seen some pretty doggone good skill saw mechanics.
Yeah.
I've seen some pretty good ones.
Yeah.
And some of them, I've seen one or two that did some pretty doggone good cabinet work with them. But at the same time, they had to use a lot of filter.
Well, yeah, and the other
thing is... Old Englishman I served my apprenticeship under. Would have had conniptions if he'd ever seen. Well, if one of us ever used it as an apprentice, we used any filler even. We'd have to do penance for a couple of weeks. I'm working on trucks before he lets go back work on the body again. But no, you'd ask about Marin's family. Yeah, I got their father. Her mother's father owned a plantation down the Cape Fear River in North Carolina, out of Wilmington, North Carolina. And she was out school teaching out in Minnesota when she met Mr. Lee. And that's where the family came from.
And how did you meet your wife?
Well, this is funny, and it's a little bad. I was in the Army.
Which war?
World War II. Let me get straightened around. I, 1940, I knew we were going to be in it. So we were playing the Memphis, Tennessee Fair. I was general superintendent, and I just redesigned the Indoor Midway in the Beckman Gary Carnival. We were playing the Memphis Fair. DuPont was building a powder plant for England, Glenn Lease up in Middleton, Tennessee. I went out and went to work as a carpenter. I said, I got to get into this. I had already volunteered for every branch of the service and been turned down because I had a scar across my belly from a kidney stone operation. 3 weeks, I was carpenter foreman. We moved to Charleston, Indiana and built one for the United States government up there at Charleston, Indiana. In about 3 months, I was called in and given the superintendent the area superintendent's job over about 800 carpenters. And my boys did all the carpenter work on the biggest downdraft powerhouse, 8 downdraft boilers on that big Charleston, Indiana power plant. My draft board was giving me problems all the time. Mind you, I was 34 years old already. My draft board was giving me problems. I was tearing up papers. Didn't have time to fill them up, and it's always going to happen. There's not a damn thing to do about it. When the Japs' submarine came up and bombed and shelled a refinery in Santa Barbara, California, the next morning I took off and went down to Nashville, Tennessee, and I was registered for the draft in Tennessee, incidentally. My mother was living there then again. She moved back. And went down to Nashville, Tennessee, and signed up as chief petty officer in the Seabees, doing exactly the same work I was doing. I was turned down with 3 down Navy doctors for medical reasons. Not fit for any type of military duty. Get your butt out of here. Of course, I was overage started with. So I went up to DuPont and quit. I was on $821 a month. I went up and quit. You asked me how I met my wife. I had to bring it up to it.
Yeah, sorry.
I got 8 days later, I was in the Army. I was drafted and inducted in spite of the scar on my belly. They said, that's a big appendage scar. And I said, it sure is. The doctor had it in his hand what it was. I took basic training. My 35th birthday, I was in Aberdeen Proving Ground taking basic training in ordnance. I had to start to become a colonel later on. He's a captain then. He saw me in cadre school and recognized me, and I didn't recognize him. I'd been superintendent of Mash Goodman's Carnival 1 year, which I built, and he recognized me. He's one of my truck drivers, but he had ROC or CT commission, and he wanted me as his cadre chief of section. We started the field training branch for ordnance. They didn't let us do anything. It was General Somerville of ordnance. I was a corporal when I was in this meeting. We don't need anything like that. We only lost two men in World War I. One of them fell overboard and the other kicked by a mule. But they let us start it. And I went up like a beef staff sergeant. They tried to force me to go to OCS, but I'm too old to go to OCS. I had one of the highest IQs. I'm bragging now. I had one of the highest IQs in the Army. And I can prove. So that's what they allowed me. But anyway, you'll find the high IQ boys never went to OCS. They have it. They'd much rather be a staff sergeant, master sergeant, something like that, because they're running the war that way. The officers weren't doing it. So anyway, we got out to California, San Anita Racetrack, had all everything ready to train troops out in the desert, but they didn't give us any troops. Kasserine Pass came along. Because of Kasserine Pass, the war in North Africa lasts 3 months longer. It should have been 3 months longer to round Rommel up, bring him back through the pass. The 40th Ordnance was in Kasserine Pass. 1,018 of the best men I ever knew around Aberdeen. Without one day in the field. They didn't fire a shot. There were 11 of them left. Rommel went through the pass. They could have helped the pass with ease if they had known how to handle themselves in the field. They liked to kill us for the next 6 months in the California desert. They sent us men and been in the ordnance for 10, 15 years and they were at a day in the field. We had to train them. I had got a lot of show men. I had asked for a lot of show hands as they come into ordnance, and they wouldn't let us. We didn't have any TA for them, or TO for them. We didn't have any TA for material. I stole all the material I had all beneath there. I stole it all, had it out in the tents out in the desert, all staged. So we trained 110,000 ordnance troops in the next year and a half in California desert. In the process, I broke myself down pretty bad. As soon as we got the last troop trained, I checked in the hospital. They wouldn't let me go overseas, a DOS scar across my belly. I wasn't supposed to be there to start with, anything like that. I checked in the hospital. My wife tells everybody that she worked in the psycho wards, and she did. Teach them art therapy. She used their art therapy, and she was one of the originators of art therapy in the United States Army, and they use it now regularly, or what she originated. She tells everybody she was in the Nalak ward. She was. Then on the next breath, she tells everybody that she met me in the Army hospital. She did. And I had to tell everybody right quick that I knew the captain psychiatrist in the Army hospital, in civilian life. So when I wound up over there and couldn't talk, I lost my voice, among other things. Although I couldn't talk, I wound up in that locked ward, but he knew me, so I was in the open ward out there. That's where we did our courting.
Very good.
You want to know, that's a long story, but that's how it happened.
That's how it worked. No,
that's how it worked out. I'd probably been gone a lot of long ago, but I'd have stayed out on the shoals, and would have, my ulcers would have eaten me up. I had ulcers. I didn't let the Army know I had ulcers then. They would probably kill me there, taking them out. I never said anything about that. I'm taking all sorts of things to keep pain out. It was so bitter, ulcer. And the Lord's mouth was sealed it up. Excuse me a minute, I have another problem.
Yes, sir.
I want to say this, that it's hard, very difficult, for the average person, particularly if they haven't run into things like this, to realize that some of we outdoor circus, outdoor showmen, not circus people, but outdoor showmen, could do almost anything that come along in our trade, in our profession. And with my background and apprenticeship and all the other, I have never backed down on any doggone thing that can be done but with your hands that any other man has ever done. I even play saxophone. I never was very good at it, but I have played saxophone. But and clarinet and oboe. But it's a matter there that we outdoor showmen, as a tribe, they don't exist anymore because the shows are mechanized. What outdoor shows we do have today are mechanized. But we old-time outdoor showmen, there wasn't a bloody doggone thing around one of them that we couldn't do. So when somebody tries to, some overeducated jerk, tries to pin you down, pin us down on what we did around there, it's a pretty much an impossibility because we changed jobs for quite frequently, went from one to the other because it wasn't a thing around there we couldn't do. I would like to keep that on tape from now on because it, so few people can realize that it was the whole nature of the beast. If you want to know the truth about it, the whole nature of it.
Well, as you were saying, I think you put it very well. You said when you're in a, as we are today, in a very specialized world.
In a specialized world.
It's hard to understand.
It's difficult for our people to understand it. I know that. I understand that. And when you go to a newspaper interview, the thing that one of caused me to cut out newspaper interviews, a guy come down from Tampa one year, Tampa newspaper, one of the papers up there, and he caught me. I was working under a wagon on a gear, which is about as nasty a work as anybody could ever do. Mm-hmm. Not my trade in any way, shape, form, or fashion, but I did it. Who else out there was going to do it?
That's right. No.
The wood carver damn sure couldn't do it. Build a wagon gear. And so I was underneath working. I had dirty work clothes on and everything. And he took my picture. I didn't think anything about it. I'll give him an interview. The headline man, it wasn't his fault there. The headline, there's another guy writes the headlines only. From circus roustabout to curator of the Ringling Museum of the Circus. And here that dirty picture of me under there, which is an insult. And circus roustabout is a deadly insult. Because every little doggone Kansasman that we recruited by three carloads a week. On the Ringling Show, three coachloads a week were sent from the Deep South, the blacks, to the Ringling Show, and they went through three carloads of a week. That was a roustabout. He didn't even know his terminology, you see.
Yeah.
And so that's when I cut out no more interviews with any newspaper.
Yeah.
Unless I read the story before it was published. And none of the city editors will let you do that. His name, the one, I tell him I'm going to sue him if he use my name, and they either leave me out or let me read the story once.
Well, I think this goes back to, I think it's knowledge on a very basic level. It doesn't have anything to do with schooling.
Yeah.
And that if you've ever had the opportunity to work physically, or in a situation where, something has to get done and there's no other way to do it except if you do it, then that kind of knowledge, that kind of schooling is what, you're aware of. Otherwise, you don't know what the hell's going on.
Take this off. Don't put the tape on this. I won't tell you a story about it, though. And it had no... I cut it down to three building complex from his five.
Yeah.
From Miller's five that he had. And where it would all be workable. And the last building would have been the one that would have picked up all the different things. Push buttons showing, and I had what was going to be how a train unloading scene with the end of the flat car sticking out of the wall. Diorama showing the flat car back in there in the train yards. The end of a flat car sticking out of the wall and about 6 foot of a wagon coming out of the wall on the flat. That had been full scale actually. Another wagon in the chutes. I had the chutes over there. That's the steel runs. Incidentally, the minute I got away, the summer I got away over there, they cut all that stuff up and scrapped it. art museum director, had it all scrapped and hauled off. I had one old building full of every conceivable piece of iron, and this is in the field we're talking about now, every conceivable piece of iron that could be used on the Ringland wagon. Bull rings, corner irons with bullring for the bull rings, ladders, brake beams, brake levers, possum billy hangers, hangers for pole hangers on the side, wagon gears, complete wagon gears. I had 11 complete wagon gears. That's a gear, incidentally, on a wagon. Is the thing that the axles and the wheels and the things that pull that the wagon is moved around with. Fifth wheels. The fifth wheel is the double wheel. One of them goes on the gear and one of them goes on the bottom of the wagon. So the front, you can guide it around and do a 360-degree circle with the wagon with it on the fifth wheel. I did all that, every piece of it. And the sad thing about it, every piece of it had been made in hand, portable hand forges by Ringland Brothers and Barnum Bailey master blacksmiths. Outside of the stuff that's on the wagons over there now, isn't a piece of it in existence today because that dirty it. So the director of the art museums had it all hauled off as scrap. That's almost before I got out of town in the spring of 81, I believe it was.
Well, what I can't understand, Mr. McKinnon, is what was the reasoning that this man had? In other words, if this was an actual artifact, why would he throw it away?
It was left. I had the stuff stored in a room by way back out of the way. I had it all stored back here in a huge room. So any restoration work we needed to do on any of the wagons, we had authentic parts for it in the steel. The wood, why you replace that and
no problem.
No problem. But the steel, nobody can make that stuff today like that anymore, even make it look like it. And I had it there. We had to go back on this particular director. He's no longer over there. When he came down from a little museum up in South Carolina, and I could get affidavits from co-workers up there, at least I could a couple, 10 years ago when he come down about 15 years ago now. Oh, not that long, about 13 years ago. He bragged about, when he came down, and he was a good friend of mine in a way until this business happened. He said to all his co-workers, said, "You're going down there to wear a clown suit. Leave this art world and go down there and wear a clown suit because of search me." And I told him I wasn't going to do anything of the sort. He didn't tell us that when he got down here, but his co-workers, they did. I could get affidavits from two or three co-workers. One of them lived at the art museum at the Asheville, North Carolina at the present time. And he said, I'm going down there and close up that damn service museum. And anyway, he pretty well did. He emasculated every way he could. He was under him when the last tape recordings went out. Why, he wouldn't let us have another one. So it became a static exhibit. Never had any janitorial service. When lighting went out, when they installed other lighting, it was altogether different from what we planned. He told the directors, he told the trustees, the place was dirty, which it was, and hadn't had any janitorial service in 15 years. They never let us have any. Said it was static, which it was, and cut out the sound. Never had gotten the sound stations to legislature appropriate the money for it. Never got them. I said it was, so the trustees didn't know any better. although their avowed intention was to hound this man out of his job, which it did. But they took his word for it and took the little exhibit out. They concreted over the horseshoe tracks, wagon car tracks, and everything, and embedded in there. They concreted over that. They put a low ceiling in to kill out any possibility of ever having the sky that we had planned in that thing.
What kind of sky did you have planned? I mean, was it going to be a dome, or what were we going to
have?
It
was all dome. That roof, that's a dome roof up there, you see. You did have some girders in, but you could paint the girders where it would blend in, you know.
Why did you want to have a sky up there? What was the idea?
For indirect lighting, the sunset, showing what time of day it was and everything, you see. It was just part of the overall decorating scheme of the thing. Now I got to let the trustees got the money for the main building where the sideshow front is, which they're going to dismantle it and take it out, I think. That building was designed for nothing but that front, a couple of ticket wagons and concession stands, and a vista right down at Circus Midway. When the third wheel building was to go in, we'd take care of the clutter and stuff that we had to store in this other place. Well, we never had, but when we opened the building, I had five vistas. But I had gotten the idea for these vistas from the Art Museum in Amsterdam. Have you ever been there?
Well, only to the airport in Amsterdam.
Huh?
Only to the airport. No, I've not been to the Art Museum.
You want to go down there and see Night Watch. There's seven vistas in the Art Museum in Amsterdam. Each one of them a nice gallery. Good painting on the side, and a heroic painting at the end. That's the vista you got when you come into the gallery. You go out of there, you're gonna hit another vista. The seventh vista is Night Watch. When we got open, on our grand opening of the second big building, I had five of the vistas. It was laid out for seven or eight, maybe eight vistas. I don't like the word number seven, so it could have been eight, probably eight vistas to go